broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to the Investor Exchange. Tune in each week and listen to the guys from United Global Capital discuss the topics that matter the most to your finances. Each episode will help you separate the noise from what really matters, giving you timely and actionable information you can use. We'll cover areas related to financial markets, property, politics, personal finance, and the economy. Now, here's your host.
There was a heavy hitter meeting in Melbourne. So the three major regulators were all in town for a FINSIA event. So that's APRA, ASIC, and also the RBA.
Well, there's a couple of personality shakers.
Isn't well, the part of it I was interested in was the words that the Reserve Bank Deputy Governor Guy DeBell had to say. So he was talking about how successful they'd been with the initiatives they've put in over the last few years in easing the property market. And so he's saying, you know, giving himself a pat on the back to some degree. And the one thing he highlighted was that he sees that the biggest risk to the Australian economy from tighter lending standards is not actually the impact on households, but rather on the property developers.
Mm, yeah, right.
So part of the reasoning behind this tightening in credit for developers of residential property that reflects how the lenders are reducing their desired exposure to dwelling construction. So obviously developers have a different form of loans than what everyday Australians do that are just getting mortgages.
Yeah.
We've been hearing from a number of different lenders and different developers over the last 6 months that the majority of the major banks are just not lending unless you've got a significant track record and relationship with them.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of property developers out there, got small or medium-sized development companies that are quite successful, but they're no longer able to get the type of debt they were able to get before to build these new dwellings. And so that's starting to have a knock-on effect. The impact of that, from our perspective, comes back to the property market being, like any market, a supply-demand-driven market. Yep. And if we look at what the supply-demand factors are in property, we break them down to the supply can really only be the amount of people that want to list their property for sale and then the amount of new supply that comes onto the market. That's it. Yep. There's no other factor that can really influence supply.
Yep.
And then on the demand side, it's the population growth on one hand, but it's also the access to finance on the other. And access to finance is the one that's probably been hit the most and has impacted the demand side. So these are always being the two factors, the supply and demand, that are keeping the market in balance or dictating whether the market's sort of values are growing or declining.
Yep.
And one of the things I thought was interesting, if you look at it from the perspective of the changing shape of Australia's population. There's a chart here that shows if we go back to 1997, the majority of Australia's migration, where do you think it came from in terms of overseas migration?
UK.
Yep. 13, that was the bulk of it, followed by China and then South Africa. Okay, if we fast forward 2001, still the UK leading South Africa.
India?
Okay, doesn't... Until 2003, India takes second place, but still a long way behind the UK. Skip forward a bit more. 2006, UK still leads the way in terms of most migration.
Wow.
2009, still the UK.
Really?
Right. Now, in 2010, you can see the gap's closing.
Yeah.
And it's still the UK, but only slightly ahead of China and then India. Mm. So the shift is coming. Now, that was probably around the time that we're coming out of the GFC and the construction boom in property started to happen with a lot of the high-density dwellings starting to come about.
Wait, hang on. I read the Herald Sun and I thought it was all African gangs.
Yeah, that's they're in the outer suburbs, but there's not a whole lot of them.
Right, okay. Yeah.
So if I look down, I'm not seeing. No, they don't even rate a mention in the top 10 countries of where it's coming from.
Oh, very good.
Okay, well, so the first year that that UK were knocked off top spot from Australia's net migration was 2011 when China took over.
2011.
Yeah,
right.
And India were then in third place. So a pretty closely run race by those three.
Yep.
And so since then, India have then taken the lead and by quite a fair way, and the UK are dropping back to third behind India and China, but the numbers are significantly higher, and that's pretty much been the case for the last 4 or 5 years.
So India is now leading the way in terms of net migration.
Net migration, Yep. And followed by China, and then the UK, and then we have the Philippines, Pakistan, Vietnam, etc.
Yeah.
So we have migration from a family perspective. We have migration from a skilled workers immigration. Mm-hmm. And then there's humanitarian.
Yeah.
So those that are being allowed into our borders, refugees and alike.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so that's only a very small portion. But in terms of, so it's the skilled migration that's become the biggest portion of that. And the majority of that is coming out of India. So there's a lot of educated, trained people coming out of India that are able to come over here and get jobs. Now, the thing I thought was interesting, when you look at those two countries leading the way with migration, they're highly densely populated countries typically. So there's a culture there of living in dense cities and small dwellings. Mm-hmm. So it tends to make sense if I'm a developer that if I'm going to create stock for a growing population, what sort of stock would I want to build?
Well, you'd be units.
You would, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
And so you can sort of see with the change of population from 2011 through to now, being based from those two countries, the majority of dwelling approvals and the majority of buildings we're seeing going on is high-density apartments. Yeah. So it's like, you know, if I'm in business, I want to meet the market. I want to sell what they want. Okay. But the issue that I'm now starting to see wash through is that they're starting to become some second generation of those migrants, yep. And they're also, having been here for a while, they're starting to become wealthier and they're starting to be a bit more westernized in their thinking, and they're starting to see the attraction of having bigger dwellings and moving out.
Right.
So a lot of, you know, what we were catering for is starting to shift. So that's where we're seeing a lot of the gloom and doom that people are talking about in property declines. The majority of it is in the high density apartment sector.
I would have just thought, though, that as migration increases, you know, the new lot of people would be taking, you know, the units and the high rises, and people, as you said, get wealthier and they take the dwellings that are further out or the house.
Yeah, but I think they're also finding that a lot of the time when people are coming from a foreign country, there's already communities here that they're sounding out and they're getting guidance from. They'll go and live in those areas.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you look around Melbourne, there's definitely areas of the city that that have, you know, more Vietnamese, more Indian, more Chinese. So they sort of, you know, before they move here, they're probably sounding that out through their family and friends.
Mm-hmm.
And that's starting to happen. Thought that was an interesting bit of information because it's linked with some other data that came out recently. 30% of new apartments settling in both Sydney and Melbourne are settling at below their contract price in terms of valuation. Valuations are coming in short.
30%. Wow.
Yeah. So that's where it's having an impact because, you know, if you bought off the plan 2 years, 3 years ago and it took a while for that dwelling to be built, you as a purchaser are probably going to end up short in terms of how much the bank will lend you, and you've got to find that money yourself.
Yeah.
And that's where the risk of people not being able to settle comes about. That stock then needs to come back onto the market. If there's a high volume of that, the prices are going to decline, and that's what's the impact on dwelling prices, mainly in the high density area.
In the high density areas, yeah. Mm. Mm.
So, yeah, it's interesting how all that comes together. Now, something else I just wanted to touch on that's not directly related to that. You're talking about GE and Jack Welch.
Yep.
Just this week, too, the CEO of the REA Group has moved on. So REA Group, owned by News Corp, so she's been promoted.
You mean the owner of realestate.com?
Yeah, sorry, realestate.com. Yeah, I should clarify that. So Tracy Fellows has been in the role for a few years, obviously done a really good job, and News Corp has said, right, we want you to go on to a bigger role of global real estate for all of News Corp. And I just wanted to touch on the two main players in Australia because a lot of the time what we're dealing with in property and trying to make decisions about it is driven by the media and the hype and the perception.
Yep.
And there's two really big players when it comes to media influence, data, and if you're going to sell property, where you go to. So it's REA and Domain.
Mm.
Even what REA has, you know, just announced with her leaving, I thought I'd just give some listeners a little bit of background on those two in terms of size and how much they turn over. So REA is the dominant force by a long, long way.
By a mile.
Yeah. Like Domain's well known, but REA is dominant. So as we said before, REA owned by News Corp.
Yep.
And Domain owned by Fairfax. So they've got big, powerful media houses behind them as well. Now, in terms of residential revenue growth, so their revenue from residential, there's, you know, advertising with them. In 2018, the first half, realestate.com generated $324 million in revenue for that. By comparison, Domain, $86.1 million.
Oh, wow. So there's a huge difference.
So it's massive. That's Australia-wide.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I would say that arguably the biggest player in the media space for Australian property would have to be REA, given the volume of eyeballs, the amount of dollars being spent there.
Yeah,
that's definitely significant. Yeah. Obviously, there's other players. I think CoreLogic are a big player because they're releasing data, but they're not always releasing opinions. They're releasing data based on facts as well.
And research.
How much does that translate into market influence, though? I mean, obviously, News Corp-owned company would then translate into News Corp newspapers writing things about the market.
Yeah.
But how does the revenue of realestate.com, where it's really just the eyeballs on the transactions of buying and selling, does that translate to a lot of people reading their blog articles and their other publications?
Look, I haven't got data to support that, but I believe yes. Because if you go to realestate.com or domain at any time now, and you're there doing your own research on a house or looking for a property to rent, the website doesn't just show you that. They've got article advertisements and other things around it. Like
That's
if you
true.
Go to The Age right now, and if you look under the property section, everything's domain linked.
Mm. Yep.
So, you know, they're all closely intertwined. So they're both feeding off each other, you know, the assets
true.
That each group
has. And when you're looking at a particular listing on real estate or domain, you'll see comparisons with local area, the median prices and data, and that will then take you to their resources.
Yes.
So you're in their network of, of information.
Mm. Yeah.
Very interesting.
So they are, I would say they're two of the strongest influences in terms of public perception.
Something to think about. Mm. All right, well, we'll just head to a very, very quick break and we'll be back in a second.
Are you concerned about your finances? Maybe you're not sure if you'll have enough money to retire on. Or maybe you've received a redundancy, inheritance, or even a significant promotion, or perhaps a life-changing medical diagnosis. Regardless of your concern or financial position, United Global Capital's advisors are experts in the areas of strategic financial planning, taxation, superannuation and self-managed superannuation funds, risk management, estate planning, and investments. Don't let fate dictate your financial future. Take control today and contact United Global Capital for a no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Simply call 03 8657 7640 or email info@ugc.net.au. And book your appointment today.
I'd like to discuss a little bit of clickbait, opinions, statistics. So a whole bunch of things that I've seen this week that I thought were worthy of discussion. Here's a headline for you. Australian property prices will crash 50% in 2019.
Is that Harry
Gotta
Dent?
Love that one.
Is that Harry
well,
Dent?
Well,
no,
okay.
Is it Stephen Keane?
You're getting close. When you hear who it's from, you'd actually go, what? What? Why are they saying that? It's actually from Saxo Bank.
Right, okay.
Who?
But Saxo. Yeah.
Saxo. Okay.
Okay, but
fill me in, Joel. Who's Saxo Bank?
Well, we trade with Saxo.
I know we do, but our listeners don't know that.
Very
Is
true.
Saxo Bank some weird foreign
tier
50-year lender, or
no,
are they
they're
a
very
major
large,
international player?
Very large Dutch bank, Dutch-based bank. Not Dutch, sorry, Danish bank. Mm. That we use to trade global markets here at United Global Capital.
So they're not dummies.
No.
Big international players.
No, that's right.
Thank you.
But Brett, come on.
Okay, we'll get to the point. So, well, like a lot of those big institutions, they have their research and their reporting that they do on a regular basis, but this is their annual tongue-in-cheek outrageous predictions.
Oh, okay.
So it's not really what they think, but it does make a really good headline. I thought it was worth mentioning that that's the kind of thing, if you just read headlines, you could be influenced by.
There you go.
Yeah. But the other thing, statistic-wise, the last week, clearance rates are really in severe decline. If we look at where they are currently now, clearance rates, obviously, measurement of auction activity and how many properties are selling at auction. Now, typically in Australia, that's really two major cities, Sydney and Melbourne, that are strong with auctions. So it's not a complete measure because, you know, a lot of the other capital cities don't run auction campaigns to the same level.
They favour the private sale
Private
method.
Treaties, yeah. Mm-hmm. But if we have a look at the weekly clearance rate for the combined capital cities, you know, as put forward by CoreLogic, so they're taking it across all of the capitals and bundling it together. It hit a peak with a clearance rate across the nation at around 80% in early 2015.
Right.
Okay, it stayed pretty steady in the sort of 70 to 80% bandwidth all the way through until early 2017, but the trend's been pretty downward ever since.
Right.
To where we're currently in the low 40s.
Low 40s, okay.
Typical methodology around clearance rates to talk about the impact on the market is that a balanced market where supply and demand is in balance is in around the sort of low 60s. Mm. So when it's above 60%, you'd say that it's a seller's market, the demand's really high. When it's below 60%, it's a buyer's market where there's less buyers than there are sellers. So for it to be as low as 42-odd%, so they're saying that Melbourne's at 43%, and we're the biggest auction market in the country. We've always got, you know, probably about 20% higher than Sydney, and Sydney's probably, you know, about 80% in front of the other cities.
Mm.
So for the Melbourne market to be that low shows that there's definitely a lot of weakness in the market. But of course, we know the reasons why. And a lot of it is because of the lack of the major two things that have had this impact over that timeline of declining clearance rates has been the offshore investors not being able to come into the market, and of course the credit limits that have been put on.
That's right.
And so I saw some other interesting stats here around the credit as well. And now I know we haven't been a big fan of AMP over our journey here on the podcast, but they do have some smart people in there. I quite like sometimes what their economist Shane Oliver has to say. It's well considered. And he's actually said that he believes the next move from the RBA will actually be downwards.
Down,
really?
Yeah. So for a long time, you know, everyone's been predicting that the next rate move will be up. You know, with the cycle will change and interest rates will increase.
Yep.
But he's actually said that with the way the economy is trending and growth is likely to be stuck sort of in that 2.5 to 3% for the year ahead, he sort of sees a bundle of issues that will see the next rate cut or the next rate movement being actually a cut. So he says, given the combination of falling house prices, tightening credit conditions, constrained growth, which will keep wages growth weak and inflation below target, they're now changing their view from anticipating rates to be on hold until the second half of 2020 to now seeing the next move being a rate cut.
And when do they think that the rate cut might likely occur?
Well, they don't actually say when.
Okay.
They just sort of say that the next move is more than likely downwards.
Yeah, gotcha. Mm. Gotcha.
I think there would still be a fair bit of data to change because we would start hearing it from the Reserve Bank meeting minutes and such.
Yep. Yeah.
Before it actually happens.
Yeah.
But it's very interesting that one of the major economists, most prominent economists in Australia, Shane Oliver, is now predicting this.
Mm. Mm. Yep.
Very interesting.
Yeah. One other bit of data that I saw I thought was worth reviewing is a review of the 2018 year for the big three cities on the eastern seaboard, so Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane's property markets.
Right.
So statistically, from CoreLogic, Sydney's dwelling values have dropped 8.1% November to November.
November to November. Okay, that's a pretty healthy correction.
Yeah, it is a correction. Yep.
Healthy correction.
And they've seen that a lot of that's happened. So whilst they're saying the wider market is weakening, they're continuing to see settlement valuations not meeting off the planned purchase prices. So a lot of it's in the new stock coming onto the market, not meeting valuation. And they said that, you know, from the peak in July and August of last year, they've already had some of the submarkets seeing values coming back. So overall, they're saying that Sydney is a declining market as they sort of try to wind down 2018. Moving on to Melbourne, still a decline, not quite as severe as Sydney, but average dwelling values have fallen by 5.8%.
Okay.
So a lot of that's been the concerns around an oversupply in the apartment market, and that's led to declines in pricing, mainly around the inner suburbs, the high-density areas.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Interestingly, though, some of the outer areas, such as Miquelon, Craigieburn, Wollert, have actually seen some growth in pricing over the same period.
Mm. From new stock.
New stock, yeah, so new land releases. So as an example, the median house price in Miquelon, which is sort of out towards the airport there, has gone from $520,000 to
$540,000.
Oh, okay. So I guess the takeaway from a lot of this data is that, you know, there'll still be opportunities. The overall property market is in decline based on all the statistics, but, you know, as we've always said, markets within markets, if you know what you're doing, you can find opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that's what people forget about the property market is it's not it's not a whole market. It is that market within markets that you mention. So it's not a reason to stay on the sidelines. It just means you can't go without doing your homework and your research like maybe people thought they could.
Mm. And
people have thought if you just buy a property, well, then it will go up over time. Yeah. But it's not necessarily the case.
No.
And if you look at the long-term trend as well, over any 10-year period, which is a decent investment time frame, you're going to have areas that show little or no growth, and you're going to have areas that show significant growth. Yeah. And that's really what you should be aiming for, mm-hmm. not the year-to-year fluctuations. But there's all the analytics that need to go into it in order to make a good investment decision.
Yep,
most definitely.
And we've repeatedly said if you're buying property for investment purposes, it's a long-term horizon, 10 years plus.
Yep.
You're not trying to time it because you obviously, you know, entrance and exit costs of property are high, so you need to be in it for the long term. Mm. So, and the main reason, you know, you're going to be in it for the long term, the main thing you have to be on top of is making sure that you've got your finances in order so you can hold it for the long term. You're not putting yourself under too much financial stress to maintain or service any debt you're taking on.
Yep. Which is why I start to get nervous when someone says, I want to buy a property in such and such location because things are going off there right now. I'm like, oh, are they?
Yeah.
So you're telling me the price has already moved,
yep.
and now you're going to buy in.
It's too late.
But you've got that short-term horizon, not the long-term investment horizon.
Yeah.
Always concerning.
Well, and look, one last bit of data whilst we're on the topic, though, was the amount of negative equity. So around the same context.
Ooh, okay.
So it is on the rise in all states other than, I believe, other than Queensland.
Right.
Mm. So, I mean, it's not growing a lot, but it is on the rise from where it was 12 months ago. So, of course, that you would assume with a lot of buyers that would have bought 12, 18 months ago, and a lot of the time first-home buyers or sometimes, you know, investors without a lot of capital to put down are getting high LVRs. They're borrowing at 90%.
Mm.
So if the property market has declined or, the values in the area they've bought have declined that 8%, maybe 10%, chances are their property is worth less than what they paid and therefore less than what the loan they've got.
Especially if they've already paid 4 or 5% stamp duty as well.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, by the time you look at your total outlay to own, if the values have pulled back a little bit, you could be underwater according to where you're at. So that's where I think it's critical that if you're going to invest in property, make sure that you're not putting yourself under too much pressure because then you'll be forced to sell and that's a loss-making venture.
Yeah,
exactly. Mm. Well, thank you, Brett. Great to hear what you've been seeing in the news and in the property markets for the last week. Thank you, Brett.
Want to learn the strategies that have achieved returns more than double the return of the average superannuation fund? Each day, clients of United Global Capital are using strategies and tactics that were once thought the domain of the professional investor or the super rich. Book your seat at UGC's Financial Fast Track Seminars, where you'll learn the science behind selecting high-performance stocks and real estate, how you can participate in advanced strategies like property development, short selling, and international investments, as well as how to protect your wealth against major adverse market events. To secure your seat, simply go to ugc.net.au/events and select the seminar that suits your needs. Seats are limited, so book your spot now.
Okay, welcome back, guys. Now we'll actually throw over to Brett to kick us off with the next topic.
Yeah, I've got a bit to say. Given what we've spoken about in the property market, residential property market in particular, over the recent months, there's no doubt it's in decline. House values have been known to be in decline across the country, but that's what's the current market conditions. What does the future hold? That's always, if you're investing, it's not necessarily about what's happening now. It's about what's the long-term projection going to be. And QBE have released a report, which I found quite ironic considering they're an insurer. I'm wondering why they're releasing reports about real estate. But they've released what they've called the Australian Housing Outlook for 2018 to 2021. And I thought some of the information would be worth having a look into. So just to give a quick background about the report, so they say it provides an analysis and forecast of the key drivers influencing the residential housing market nationally, as well as across each of Australia's state and territory capital cities and selected regional centres. So the data behind it didn't actually come from QBE. They've just collated it and put it into a nice, well-branded document. But it's come from Biz Oxford Economics, who I'm going to start putting on my radar now to see how their reports and research stacks up. But the information that I thought was worth having a look at, a lot of the report, it's like 60-odd pages, and I think it's readily available for anyone to download. But a lot of the report just tells you the stats around where we're at the moment, which we've discussed previously, so nothing really new there. But I thought the ones that could be of interest is where do they actually see the housing market in that time frame and at the end of it in 2021? Where do they see housing values getting there? So the one chart or the one table that spells this out is the one where they've separated into houses and units, and they've got forecast growth between the 3 years, 2018 to 2021, for each major capital city in Australia. Anyone want to hazard a guess as to whether they're up or down over that period of time?
I'm going to say down.
Down?
Yeah.
Yeah. Joel, that's, Louis, any
that would
idea?
Be the consensus.
Consensus?
Yeah. From the noise of the media.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, if you look at the country as a whole, they're saying up. Okay. But city by city, it varies.
Yeah.
Okay.
So interestingly enough, the two major cities that are always the dominant ones for property, Sydney and Melbourne, they're actually saying that over that three-year period, they're expecting them both to be down.
Yep. Right. I would agree with okay. that.
Yeah. Yep. Between now and 2021. Now, the amount is for Sydney, they're saying it from now to 2021, it'll be down 1.2%. And for Melbourne, they're estimating 2.5%.
Not catastrophic by any means.
Not at all.
Okay. Interesting, though. I wouldn't have thought Melbourne would have been. I would have thought the other way around.
Sydney would drop more?
Yep.
But well, these are, and sorry, this is taking into account that prices have already dropped from the past 12 months.
Yes, so as of from as now. From now.
Okay.
But the interesting thing, too, in terms of that's their overall outlook from now to the 3 years, yep. but they do it on a year-by-year basis to say what they see happening each year to get right. there. And the way they forecast Melbourne and Sydney is that they both actually decline more in 2019, level out in 2020, and actually increase in 2021.
Right.
Okay.
So that net position they're actually saying is on the back of a year of growth in 2021.
What do you think?
Look, I can't see a reason to argue with it.
Mm.
You know, obviously, we've spoken in the past on our show about, you know, the different data and research we read into, and I'm not seeing any significant reason why this couldn't be the case.
Yeah.
It does appear to be on the money with general consensus and expectations.
Well, I'm no expert on property, but, I mean, you know, certainly with the market going up and up and up, how much further can it potentially grow? I mean, how many people have money to actually get in anymore once they've purchased their homes?
That's a really tough one too, because that same question has been asked for as long as I can remember the property market's been around and data's been around.
Yeah.
And we always, you know, reference the data we've got from Melbourne housing over the last 50 years, and it's grown on average just under 10%, like 9.5% year on year.
But once you keep playing stamp duty and you keep changing houses all the time, how much money does people have left? And also, are these banks going to lend any further to people to actually keep increasing mortgages, though?
They will. Yeah. Like, obviously, it's tight at the moment, but a lot of the different brokers and real estate agents we're talking to, and even, you know, people with other market influence are saying, yeah, obviously the Royal Commission's had an impact and the banks are taking their medicine and they're trying to show that they're doing the right thing. But over time, their business model is to be lending and they won't be able to generate the profits unless they're lending. So there is a lull at the moment, but that will have to shift because they're, you know, the majority of their business is in the lending space. So that
think,
has
though,
to keep going.
Do you think, though, it's the overseas investor that will keep, you know, keep buying, or is it
not in particular?
Australian?
Not in particular. The overseas investor, if you listen to the project marketers that have been, you know, selling a lot of the boom product off the plan for the last 3 or 4 years, they're saying the overseas investor basically doesn't exist because of the costs that, you know, the stamp duty increases for non-resident purchases being so much higher.
It seems to be, though, the top echelons of the markets are still investing. I mean, there was a property in Sydney that sold the other day to an overseas investor worth a fortune, huh?
That's a different market altogether.
Yep.
And even though, yes, that data and those statistics do come into play when we're looking at all this information, it's hard to compare that market with the average Australian that's a wage earner.
Yep.
You know, the super wealthy, they just buy something because it's unique or it's available at a certain time. They're not dealing with, can I get a loan? Can I afford it? They're just going, I want it. And that's, I'm only going to get a chance to buy it now, so I'll pay whatever I need to pay.
Yeah. Mm. So you don't think that there's going to be a real stop on people continuing to purchase properties? It's not going to stagnate any further?
Well, no, it's not going to stagnate any further. But if you dig into this data that they've said here about, you know, a further decline next year, a leveling out in 2020, and then a slight increase in 2021. Well, a lot of that is pretty much a continuation of what we're already experiencing.
Yeah.
The pullback of the banks, it's not that they're not lending, they're just making it harder for you to get the borrowings, and they're not lending as much as they were in the past. So you can still get an amount of borrowing. So therefore, the demand softened because the buyers don't have the same amount of money at their disposal, and therefore, anyone looking to sell has to bring down their expectations.
Yep.
Now, over time, that will naturally grow. So, you know, people will get access to more funds. The banks will shift their ratios and things again.
What about interest rates over the next 3 years? Where do you think that's going to go? And will that have an impact?
Look, if I was to make a call and say, where will it be in 3 years? I imagine it's going to be pretty much where it is now.
There's not much forecast for a change, is there?
No.
There's now people saying, well, maybe it'll be up a little bit, but now people saying it'll be down a little bit.
Mm.
The consensus is not much movement.
No. Yeah. If it is, it'll be a slight move in either direction.
That's right.
Well, you had BlackRock just this week, and T. Rowe Price come out this week suggesting that the RBA might actually cut rates next year by 0.25%, but then potentially raise them back up again in 2020. So, you know, there's it's not really going to be the main mover. No. It's really the availability of credit, not so much interest rates that are driving.
I think there's another factor in here. And that is when you look at the population of Australia and its demographics, there's a real lump of population. Obviously, everyone knows that there's a lump of population in the baby boomers. Mm. So people who are now around 60, 65 and 70, there's a big amount of people in that age bracket, a disproportionate number.
Yeah.
But there's also a disproportionate number of Gen Ys.
Mm.
So people who are now mid-30s are the early Gen Ys. But that runs right down to the age of 25, 20.
Yep.
So there's this lump of population in that group, and I think that has been one of the drivers. People who are now early to mid-30s in the last few years have entered the home market for the first time, and there's a lot of them, and they're often dual income. Now that they're in their 30s, they're starting to earn good money, and they're not willing to live 20 kilometres from the from the city. Their first home is $750,000, which is unheard of in previous generations.
Yep.
But they're willing to take these massive home loans.
So, and smaller than the average house ever was.
And smaller, and that's okay.
Yep.
So those people have been purchasing in the last few years, but now that's dried up a bit.
Yep.
That pent-up demand has been released. But in another few years' time, there will be even more Gen Ys in the similar position, ready to enter the market.
So I've got this is a curious question for you. If that's the case, and nobody in our generation really wants to purchase a home that far out, or the majority don't, what happens to the baby boomers that are trying to offload their larger houses?
Well, that's the thing. They're not trying to offload them yet because the baby boomers are not dying.
But they'll want to travel. They're going to downsize.
Well, that's a big assumption that some, every one of them will want
not
to do
all
that.
Of them. Mm. Yeah.
Some will downsize, but the majority won't.
Yep.
The majority of people keep their family home and keep it for a really long time.
Yep.
When we have clients moving into aged care, they're in their 80s, and they've been in their family home for 40 or 50 years.
Yeah.
That's a long time.
And
I wonder
even
if that dynamic will shift with our generation particularly, because we are downsizing and having smaller homes, and we see more lifers, you know, wanting to have experiences rather than these larger properties with the Hills Hoist out the back.
Mm.
Will that shift in time? Do you think that's something that will actually change?
It will shift in time.
Mm. It's already started.
But as far as but the baby boomers have to move out.
Yeah.
But they're a bit too soon to die
in
big numbers.
Okay.
That's only going to happen in maybe
20
years' time.
Yeah.
Baby boomers are now only just reaching 70, early 70s. And so they're sort of the 55 to 70 age bracket, or 50 to 70 age bracket. They've got another 20 years before they start really dying out and leaving their houses vacant for the next generation. And most of those houses are going to be knocked down and replaced with two or three in their place, or this low to medium density living.
And remember, while the baby boomers were the greatest proportion of population from a percentage-wise, the millennial generation, or the Gen Ys are actually bigger in terms of quantum and numbers than the baby boomers.
I did read something interesting yesterday. It's probably fractionally off topic to this, but a lot of the baby boomers, well, not a lot of baby boomers, but there are a number of baby boomers that are now looking to Bali to actually retire, and people are renting out their family homes, getting the income from that, and apparently in Bali you can't actually, I don't think you can own property outright, but you lease for, you know, a five-year period or a year period, and it's basically offsetting their living, and they're living really well. You know, having a great old lifestyle over there, which is an interesting one to watch out for as well.
Sure is.
Something to think about in your twilight years.
And why limit it to Bali? I mean, anywhere where you can live cheaply, that you enjoy the lifestyle.
Near the beach.
Income here.
That's a great thing to say, Steph. Hey, baby boomers, here's a good reason to fuck off overseas.
Sell your property so we can knock it down and invest it and make something.
I've actually had conversations with clients about this particular. In fact, I've got two or three clients right now as part of their plan that is what they are anticipating doing for their retirement, which is, you know, keep their house that they're currently living in at the moment and rent it out and go over to the Philippines or go over to, you know, somewhere
Typically Asia, though. Yeah, it's close and cheap.
Lower cost of living and cheaper to live. Mm. And
sounds pretty good to me.
That's part of their financial strategy.
It's actually a great retirement plan.
Well, we better wrap it up there. But I might just really quickly throw over to Brett to encourage our listeners to write in. And if you have any questions, you'll give us the information on it.
So please go to our website, which is theinvestorexchange.com.au, and leave us a message either via the voice application or type it in, and we'll get to it when we can.
You've been listening to this week's episode of The Investor Exchange. To access this episode's show notes, go to theinvestorexchange.com.au and follow us on Facebook at The Investor Exchange for updates on our latest episodes. This show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. Before making any investment decision, contact United Global Capital by emailing ugc.net.au for a personalised, no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Or alternatively, email us at info@ugc.net.au.